This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You could say Mark Dorison has a passion for civil rights, but his journey to becoming a civil rights attorney was neither straight nor simple. He's bounced from one idealistic endeavor to another, and despite constant disappointment, keeps coming back for more. He's been a high school teacher, a bar owner, part-time playwright, and a public official in Carrboro, and all of those experiences have spurred his desire to fight the good fight. He's currently the managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights and a member of the Orange County Board of Commissioners. Mark Dorison joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
So I want to start this odyssey. I'm going to begin with you in Duke University in the 1980s. You get involved in divestment and the anti-apartheid movement. Tell us about what was going on, and was that your sort of moment of recognition and awareness, social consciousness, or did you been thinking about these things?
No, I think that really was the awakening that I had. I was an undergrad at Duke in the mid-80s, and the issue of divestment from South Africa became the hot issue for progressives on college campuses, pushing universities to divest their endowments. And so I attended my first demonstration. I rode up with some friends to Washington, D.C. We marched in front of the South African embassy, and from that got engaged with students at Duke who were starting protests there to try to get the university to divest. And that was my first real sort of political consciousness raising.
On the hunch that nobody goes to Duke to learn to be a protester, what did you go for? What did you think you were doing at Duke, and how did you think it was going to end up?
I think like a lot of people coming out of high school, I didn't really know what I was going to do. I just knew you went to college and was probably thinking kind of generally about going to law school. I knew some people who were doing that, and that seemed like a reasonable path. But by the time I got engaged with South Africa stuff and started getting engaged in other progressive things at Duke, I came to the realization, or at that time the realization, that going to law school would be a big sellout. So I was determined not to do that after college.
Well, now, so had you considered the possibility of being a civil rights attorney at that point? Which
I hadn't. The people I knew who were going to law school, particularly the people I knew who were a few years ahead of me at Duke who were graduating, were all going with the intent of being corporate lawyers. Again, it was sort of the heady days of the 80s mm-hmm. and Wall Street. And so that was all I knew about law school. And I didn't think it was a way to sort of make any kind of social impact.
So what did you think, and how were you going to use your college education?
I decided to become a high school teacher. I just, much to my parents' chagrin, since here I was attending Duke University, and as my mother said, you know, you could have gone to the community college to get a teaching certificate. Right. But I did get a teaching certificate at Duke, majored in education there, did my student teaching at Northern High School in Durham. Then I really was of the belief that if you wanted to be a good teacher, you ought to be an expert in what you're teaching. So I ended up getting a master's degree in history at UNC Greensboro.
And even while you were at Duke, you were involved in the anti-apartheid movement and divestment, but you also got a pretty good look at race relations at Duke and on the campus. And tell us about that experience, because you got involved there too, didn't you?
I did. And it was real. Once I sort of got involved with progressive students and folks in the community, again, starting with the South Africa stuff, you know, once you sort of have your eyes open, you see injustice everywhere. And at Duke, there was the clear sort of racial dynamics. It was at that time an overwhelmingly white student body, but all of the workers, cafeteria workers, housekeepers, were African American. There was much less town gown kind of friendly relations at that time in the 80s. So you really felt like it was an island. Very few students ever left campus. And when you did, you really began to see, particularly back then off of East Campus, the great privileges that folks on that campus had. And so that image of the inequities really stuck with me from that moment on.
Were you active at all, or was it just a moment of, again, awakening and recognition, the difference between privilege and just across the street?
It was an awakening, but there was some activism. I mean, I was helped edit what was the alternative paper at the time, The Missing Link, and again, began to really engage with folks who were doing different work in the community. And so certainly it was a lot of learning from people who were doing sort of progressive, engaged activism.
How would you say things have changed? It's interesting to think about. I mean, I think Duke was you know, called Duke Plantation at that time and for decades before. There does seem to have been a change. Duke does seem to have understood its position and its responsibility for using privilege. I mean, do you think things have changed? Is that just public relations, or is there a better relationship and a deeper understanding about how to use that privilege?
I think things have changed. I think that the university is much more actively engaged with the communities all around it. I think that there had been, from the time I was there till now, there's been sort of a general consciousness raising among the students and I think among the leadership that there is a broader responsibility that the university has. That said, I think there's still probably a long way to go.
How much would you say activism has to do with it? I mean, one of the more frustrating things about people engaged in progressive movements and social action is it seems to move awfully slowly and often produce no results at all. So with that kind of perspective and that scope and that observation, do you think social action and activism played a part in changing things and making things better?
I do. I think your comment that things change slowly is absolutely accurate. But I do think that the first step in the struggle is raising the profile of the injustices and, you know, sort of pulling back the curtain and if nothing else, exposing it and forcing the folks who are defending it to really have to stand up and take ownership of that. As a smaller example on the South Africa question, we ultimately were successful in getting the university to divest its endowment. So while generally things move more slowly, that was certainly a great victory that happened fairly quickly.
And we should point out there's a great deal of resistance at first to this idea. It's like, what are you telling us? This is money for the university. Stop it. We're not going to play with that, right?
That's right. And I think that part of the reason we were successful is it became a national movement. So you know, had we been just one university just trying to make this struggle, I think it would have been much more challenging.
Now, you're talking about teaching. You're going to be in the classroom. You decide actually to know a little bit about what you're going to teach, a radical idea by itself. You're going to teach history. How did that go? Tell us about your first teaching.
So I will just say up front, if there's a theme, I guess, as I was listening to the introduction, if there's a theme that to my adventures, it's probably naive optimism. So I went into teaching thinking that I would be working with lots of folks who went into the profession as a way of really making social change, making a difference in the lives of young people who would then go out and make a difference in the world. And that, you know, there were some folks certainly there, but overall that was not the case. And so I found it very challenging. The classroom itself was incredibly rewarding and challenging to be sure, but the bureaucracy of the school was, and the school system was really shocking.
Well, you talked about teaching what we would call at-risk youth. I think the term may still be about today. I know you have some theories about and feelings about that term itself. But you were working with kids who didn't have much of a chance going in, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I was, you know, a couple of my classes were tracked as at-risk youth, and which meant at that time at risk of dropping out. You know, one of the things that was really compelling is those students all knew that they were the at-risk class. And many of them had the sense that no one really cared about them or had given up on them. Many of them had given up already. I had ninth graders who said, as soon as I turn 16, I'm dropping out. There's not anything you can do. And 3 months later, on their 16th birthday, they came in, they turned in their textbook and were gone. That was heartbreaking. But I also think that I realized or I learned that being a teacher who genuinely did care about the students, if you showed that real personal interest and care, they reacted very positively. And so in my work as a civil rights lawyer now around education, we always hear that the most important resource in schools are quality teachers. And my experience certainly bears that out.
So what were the challenges that they faced? Why were they at risk of dropping out?
A lot of them came from underprivileged backgrounds. They didn't have a lot of support at home. Many of them had the class I taught, which was civics at the time, was a class you had to pass in order to graduate. So some of them were taking it for the second or third time. They had the sense that they had already failed once. I think also that many of them were had other things going on. They had family responsibilities. Many of them were working. And so there were a range of challenges outside the classroom.
You decided to leave. Tell us why.
Well, I didn't actually decide to leave. I was hired to fill in for someone who was on leave for a year and did the year and then was not invited back. And so there was a hiring freeze at the time. There was a budget shortfall in the state. So it was very difficult to get on with another school.
But did you left teaching, though?
I did leave teaching. When I wasn't able to get another teaching job, I needed to find something to sort of just cover the expenses. And so I ended up managing a Blockbuster video store in Greensboro, which was another step in sort of my, I guess, political consciousness raising.
Well, we will find out how managing a Blockbuster in the Triangle raises political consciousness when our conversation with Mark Dorison continues. He's managing attorney now at the UNC Center for Civil Rights, a member of the Orange County Board of Commissioners, and our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Mark Dorison, managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights. We're talking about teaching for a little while, and now you end up with a lot of your graduates managing a Blockbuster store.
That's right. It was not exactly the career path I had envisioned, but I loved movies, and it seemed like something that would, you know, pay the bills and keep me occupied and keep me out of trouble. As I said, what I didn't expect was that it would sort of cement my desire to go to law school. After teaching, I did have a sense that the challenges that schools faced may be better addressed by someone not in the classroom. Maybe I had could bring some skills or knowledge to some broader change. But I hadn't cemented on the idea. I was still resistant to law school at that point. Then I started working at Blockbuster, which at the time was a big corporation. And my experience as a small cog in a big corporation cemented my idea that I needed to be doing something more directive regarding social change.
For those of you who don't remember, Blockbuster was a brick-and-mortar store that rented videotapes, a medium on which you could watch what we then called movies on your VCR. And it was huge. It was a big, big deal. So you're there. But what was it about corporate culture? They did, I think, move to DVDs and then ultimately away from the world. So what was it about corporate culture that sort of awakened you to?
It was all of the details that sort of went into that corporate identity rather than sort of looking at what makes this store successful. So I had a store with several employees who had been there a long time, really cared about the job. I wanted to pay them more and wasn't allowed to. There was a very strict sort of salary schedule that you had to stick to. I remember really clearly they had this policy at Blockbuster at the time that you had to say hello to everyone who walked in the door or welcome to Blockbuster or something. It purports to be friendly, but they tell you it's actually an anti-theft method. If people feel like they've been recognized, right, they might not steal. And one day, the my boss, the regional manager, was visiting, and he came into the store, and everybody said hello to him. And during the course of his visit, he went out to his car several times to get things that he had left and kept coming back in. And about the third or fourth time, no one said hello to him anymore. And he made a point to call me aside and say, you know, they didn't say hello to me, and that, you know, that counts as a mark against your evaluation. Wow. And wow. I just, you know, it was pretty stunning.
You should have asked to look at his car. He's probably stealing videos. So yeah, that's it. I mean, it's interesting. We think of private business as the most efficient thing in the world, but that's a big giant Soviet. I mean, it's central planning, right?
That's exactly right. And you know, right down to the, you used to have to wear a blue shirt and khaki pants or brown pants, and I just always used to think of that Clash song, "Working for the Clampdown," where it says, "You've been wearing blue and brown and working for the Clampdown," and that hit me one day very clearly.
They dictate your hours, whether or not you can have overtime, how much, you know, whether or not you have health benefits and how much you're going to pay. If the government ever did that to us, we'd be screaming bloody murder, you know.
Absolutely. They also had very strict rules about what movies you could have in the store. So really, despite being the manager, you had very little control and particularly, you know, how the workers got treated was very frustrating.
So how does this drive you to law school?
Well, at that point, I was, you know, trying to figure out how to really make a difference, how to make, you know, change some of the inequities in society, and then, and you know, what are my skill sets and what resources do I have? And so at that point, I decided I could go to law school, not get co-opted, and hopefully come out and be a social justice lawyer. And so that's what I did. I ended up at UNC.
And it's amazing to me that you still have this optimism, given the challenge you faced, and I think understood, at trying to change the culture in even one school, let alone American education.
Well, you know, you look around and you see what you perceive as inequities or injustice, and you either decide you're going to do something about that, or you have to accept those. And I wasn't ready to do that, so it was try to find another path to address them.
And you volunteered with a local civil rights attorney in Chapel Hill, is that right?
That's right. I knew I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer, and I didn't really know how I was going to go about doing that. So my wife had been reading about a case that was going on at the time. This was the early 90s. Keith Edwards was an African-American policewoman who was suing the university over discrimination, and a local lawyer, Al McShirley, was representing her. And she said, why don't you just go see this guy and say, I want to be a civil rights lawyer. Can you teach me? And so I did. He said yes.
Well, and eventually, I guess you ended up being a partner there?
I did. I worked with Al for about 2 years while I was in law school. And when I was getting to graduation, he asked me what I was going to do next. And I said, I think I'm going to open a civil rights office like you did. And he said, oh, that's silly. Why don't you just become my partner? And so I like to say I was the first person in my law school class to make partner.
There you go. You have a job waiting for you. How did that case, by the way, the case you were working on, how did that come out?
That case eventually settled. And so, from Keith's perspective and our perspective, very successfully.
And you also did some work related to the housekeepers at UNC.
We did. That was one of the biggest, most important cases that I worked on as a young lawyer, and really was a transformative experience for me. We represented a class of over 400 African-American housekeepers, mostly women at the university, over pay, working conditions, opportunities for advancement, management, and were very successful in improving all of those things, although the struggle that the housekeepers are facing continues, and they're still staying organized and still struggling with the university over some of those same issues today.
Well, so you're meeting with some early success. You're getting partner right out of college, out of law school. You've got two pretty successful and high-profile cases. Sky's the limit. The civil rights stuff is working. We're changing the world, or at least Chapel Hill.
Well, there were a lot of other cases that did not end so successfully. So it was very hard work. It's still very hard work. But we lost a lot of cases, and that was frustrating. We had a big caseload because most of our clients could pay very little, if anything. And I was certainly working, 50 to 80 hours a week on cases and getting frustrated. This was, again, the early 90s, and North Carolina is a tough place to do civil rights law. So about that same time, we wanted to start a family, and I was getting burnt out on the law, and I had inherited a little bit of money when my grandfather passed away and had been thinking about buying a building to put the law office in. I have an edifice complex, my wife will tell you. And in the course of looking for that, found that someone was selling a bar in Chapel Hill, and that's the next chapter.
So you remained in the bar, so that's good.
That's right.
That's good news. So tell us about this now. So before we leave, because I want to take a look at some of the frustration, talk about being burned out. I mean, on the one hand, you've got this optimism going in. So have you understood by this point? I mean, have you internalized the idea that it is slow, kind of steady work, that you're not going to change the world? Or were you really thinking, no, this is going to be it. We can actually make some systemic change. I mean, what was going on in your mind going into this?
Well, I really believe still that we could make some systemic change. You know, Al was a great mentor and a teacher and a friend. And one of the things he taught me was that, you know, while you're working for your individual clients on individual cases, you frame that struggle more broadly. And so, again, like I mentioned earlier, you're exposing the sort of institutional discrimination that exists. And that's important, whether you win the cases or not. I think it's the raising of the consciousness is a critical aspect. But at the time, I was frustrated that we weren't winning more cases. Now, Derek Bell, a famous law professor, said once, the struggle is the victory. And in my more seasoned years, I take that to heart. Although back in the early 90s, if someone told me that, I would have said, no, that's a rationalization. The victory is the victory.
Spoken by a chronic loser. Exactly. Yeah. So, all right. So there you are. You're still kind of trying to internalize this message. You have fought the good fight. You kind of understand what's going on. Trying to build a family, want a building. You own a bar. Tell us about the bar.
Well, it was, this bar was for sale, and I just sort of got this crazy idea that we should buy a bar. It wasn't. People say to me, "Was it your dream to always own a bar?" And it really wasn't. I was enamored of the idea of owning my own business and sort of being my own boss and taking those lessons from Blockbuster and turning them around and showing how a business could be socially forward thinking. And a good friend of mine had been owned restaurants and had been involved in restaurants. And I asked him to take a look at this place with me. And after much cajoling, he was convinced that we should go forward and do it. And so we went and looked at the bar on a Monday morning, and we bought it Monday afternoon. I called my wife and I said, "I think we want to do this. Do you want to come see it before we do it?" And she says, she asked me, she said, "What does Andy say?" He was our friend in the restaurant, Andy McMillan. She said, "What does Andy say?" And I said, "He said we should do it." So she said, "Okay, I don't need to see it.
Go ahead." Now, had you talked to other people in the restaurant and bar business to tell you what a monstrous undertaking this is?
He was the only one I had talked to, and he assured me he would help. And he was an invaluable help. But no, I talked to some friends and asked them if they wanted to invest a little bit and be part of it. And they did. Everyone thought it was a great idea. And, you know, we had this It was a place that had been a bar for, I don't know, 20 years in Chapel Hill.
You called it hell.
We called it hell, yes. It's down in the basement, and we thought, so it suited the geography, and also we thought it was would be and did turn out to be a great marketing device. So telling people to go to hell.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's perfect. And you instructed all of your, I assume, all the wait staff never to say hello to anybody who comes in.
That's right.
Don't ever say hello. Just go to hell, which is, you're already there.
That's right.
So it's an easy instruction to follow. Well, so what was that like? I mean, it appears like you were looking for a business or a change. Then the bar business is its own. I mean, that's its own culture. What was that like for you?
It was great. I and my friends didn't really have a place that we like to go. I like to say I spent 18 years doing research and development on what makes a great bar and knew what I would like. And so we tried to make a bar like that, and it turned out to be a successful formula. We tapped into a group of residents that were, post-college grad students and folks who were in the service industry. And so it became a place for slightly older folks to hang out. And it was like having a party every night for 100 of your closest friends.
So were you hanging out at the bar?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. I mean, for the first few years, we were there just working all the time. Right. But one of the great things about the bar, one of the ways I would describe it as being successful, is the folks who worked there when they weren't working liked to hang out there too. And I think that was the customers really appreciated that. They appreciated that this was a place we all shared. And a lot of them really took an ownership feeling about it. It really became kind of a community institution, as pretentious as that might sound.
Well, because the danger, of course, is you get sort of involved in the bar culture, and you can get swept into some pretty dangerous behaviors and not even realize you're headed there. I mean, was that ever getting close to be a problem?
Well, you spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
You certainly, there's certainly lots of drinking that goes on. But really, again, it became a much more of a social scene. Everyone who were my friends or people who came in became friends. So it really was more like a place where you would hang out and be around your friends. And it was just a lot of fun. We had a really good time.
Were you missing the challenge of fighting the good fight, of being involved in social justice causes?
At first, no, because the bar itself took so much focus. And having a legal background really did kind of help get me up to speed. But after, after a few years, I began – when the bar sort of started running itself, essentially, or you know, it was going along mm-hmm. fairly smoothly, I began to think I ought to be doing something else. And so that's what – then I ended up running for the Carrboro Board of Aldermen.
All right. And so that was, I guess, what prompted that decision. What was that like? Now you're really in public life. You can make public policy. You don't have to rail against it. How's that?
It was not exactly as effective as I'd hoped. I guess I think everybody who does activism or social justice at some point has to confront the idea, boy, if I could just be involved with the policy making, I could really make a difference, broad and forward looking, and you know, get some of these issues, get ahead of them prospectively. And I thought Carrboro, very progressive community, the perfect place to sort of operate the laboratory of democracy. But in fact, it was the bureaucracy of local government is heavy and moves slowly, and it's hard to make big changes.
And you're operating in a political and economic milieu that is really much larger and dictates, doesn't it, a lot of what you can and cannot do at that local level. Even though we like to think all politics is local, you know, jobs, international corporations that people are working for have a lot to do with, or do they constrict the kinds of policies that you can develop?
Certainly in North Carolina, the state has a heavier control over, you know, the range of things local governments can do. But also there is a sense that the machine of government kind of rolls along by itself, even at the local level. This is the way we always did things. This is the way we do things. There was more hesitancy in taking risk than I expected, especially in Carrboro.
You did take on foreign policy in the Iraq War. The Carrboro City Council took on the board of the aldermen. What was it about you, France? You decided to, because we were excoriating France for its lack of support. We were changing French fries to freedom fries. And in Carrboro, bless their hearts, they decided to go the other way.
That's right. We had a few years earlier passed a resolution opposing the war. When all this French bashing took place, we passed a resolution declaring April by French month, or French trade month. And that got a lot of attention on the right wing internet sites and things like that.
And also fake news sites like The Daily Show and a guy named Stephen Colbert, who was at the time their correspondent, came to Carrboro and made you famous.
For months now, the French have talked a lot in French about how they'd never invade another country without provocation. Well, the helpless citizens of Carrboro, North Carolina will tell you that's just a steaming pile of merde. Which is French for shit. The French occupation has begun. The Carrboro Board of Aldermen, clearly just a puppet government installed by the Shiraki regime, unanimously passed a resolution declaring April French Appreciation Month. We secured a rare interview with power-mad alderman Mark Dorison, or what may have been one of his many doubles. He spoke to us from his giant desk of propaganda.
Alderman, that's French for douche, isn't it?
No, it's an elected title.
Oh, really?
Colbert? Is that a French name?
No, it's Native American.
Did you come up with that zinger like right then and there?
I did. It was probably one of the highlights of my life. It's a real interesting process how they do The Daily Show, but making Stephen Colbert break character with that joke was really a great moment for me.
Because I understand his comeback, which sounded pretty funny, that took a lot longer to get at.
It did. It actually did. I said the line that is Colbert a French name, and he started laughing, and they stopped. And then the producer had him run through about 17 different nationalities or ethnicities until they found one they liked, which was Native American.
That's great. So he had to work on it. You were right there. That's great. And you broke him up. That's pretty cool. What were some of the other nationalities?
Oh, he said, you know, no, it's
Portuguese, you know, it's Japanese. He went, you know, went through a Aleutian, you know, and
that's great.
The producer just kept saying, "Nick, do another one. Do another one.
That's good.
Do another one."
Do they wait till the staff laughs and pick that one, or no? They just
no. There wasn't. There's no one there. It's just a producer and Stephen Colbert and a cameraman and me. And so they just have him run through it until they get to one they like.
We're talking with Mark Dorison. He is the managing attorney at UNC Center for Civil Rights, a member now of the Orange County Board of Commissioners, and we will continue our conversation after this break. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Mark Dorison, managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights, member of the Orange County Board of Commissioners. And, I want to get back to that Colbert bit, which was on The Daily Show at the time. The Daily Show was not that widely known at the time. It was 2002, right?
I think so, yes. And so it was very interesting because I overheard some of my colleagues on the board talking about having been contacted by The Daily Show and absolutely not wanting to do it. And I said, well, please tell them to call me because I'd love to do it. And so the producer called me up finally and was talking about the program and what they wanted to do. And if you listening to it, it was clear that you wouldn't know what The Daily Show was by describing it. So he told me we're going to come and we interview you. We want to talk about this. And I said, and then cut it together so I look like an idiot, right? And there was a long pause from the producer. And he said, well, we like to think of it as using humor to make political points. And we don't really like to think of making anybody look like an idiot. And then I said, well, I don't have any problem with looking like an idiot. And then he relaxed and he said, great, we're going to come down and we'll be interviewing you.
It's funny because at the time, you're right. I mean, they would go around, they were doing these congressional districts and clearly nobody had seen the show and had no idea, you know, what they were letting themselves in for.
And it's interesting the way they do it. If you didn't know how the show worked, you could see how you would think you were just getting interviewed and it's kind of a weird interview, but you know, they put a camera on you and Stephen Colbert asks you about 100 questions, some about the issue, some just random. Then they put the camera on him and they have him read through the questions that they think they can put together with an answer. And they tell you not to answer the second time.
Oh, wow.
So I asked them how they get people to do this and they said most people leave when they're told they're not going to answer. They're just not there. Wow. So they don't see how it gets all put together. But it's an amazing process. You know, they're already cutting the skit together as they're shooting it.
Yeah, well, and that doesn't just that they don't only do that in fake news. Turns
That's
out.
Right.
Some of the big shows do that as well. So now you're on the Orange County Board of Commissioners. You leave the. Tell us about that. 10 years at the bar. You were 10 years in hell.
Yes.
And enjoying it, I guess.
I did enjoy it very much. It was a great experience. I had eased out of the sort of day to day operations. I was still kind of the general manager, but had started getting involved with the law again. I wound up teaching at UNC Law School, filling in for a year, a professor who was on leave. I went over to work at Self Help, doing some community financed community development work. Started teaching at Duke Law School for a while. And, you know, Frank, owning a bar is a young man's game. By 2007, I had 3 kids. The idea of staying up till 3 or 4 in the morning and dealing with drunk people, it just was less appealing. Also, many of the folks that I really loved seeing there had kind of aged out. So
it turns out going to a bar as a young man's
profession. That's right. It turned out not to be. I realized one day that most of the folks who were there, we were more different than more the same. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being the oldest guy in the club is never a good feeling.
Right. So you leave the bar. You decide you were already an alderman. How long had you been an alderman?
I was an alderman for one term.
Okay.
After 4 years, I had really decided that it was too frustrating. I didn't feel like I had really accomplished anything significant. I was the sort of naive optimism had worn off, and I thought, okay, well. The place to be making advocating for changes on the other side of the dais, and so chalked it up to experience, and then decided I wasn't gonna do it again.
What'd you do right after that then?
I was starting practicing law again. Yeah. So I was teaching and I was practicing law. I was doing some legal work for community organizations and nonprofits, and really enjoying that, and really starting to feel like I needed to get back to the struggle.
And now, apparently, you forget easily as well. It's like giving birth for you. You're at it again on the Orange County Board.
I am, and you're not the first person who's asked about that. I guess 10 years is the statute of limitations on learning anything for me. If you pay attention to local politics, at some point you feel like, hey, I could do that. And also, my work at the Center for Civil Rights, I do a lot of work with community organizations, helping them advocate for their interests before local governments, school boards, city councils, county commissioners. And in that work, it really occurred to me again how powerful it could be to have an ally on the policymaking side of the table, addressing some of these issues. So that led me back.
Back at it. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling optimistic. I think that hopefully I've learned a lot, and I think that I have a better sense of the limitations of the office and a better sense of my particular skills and abilities and taking that Derek Bell quote to heart that the struggle is the victory and feel like can continue to wage it from that platform.
Tell us more about your work at the Center for Civil Rights. You said some of it is working with organizations to help them, get things done. Tell us a little more.
Well, so at the center, we do a range of civil rights work. We do everything from sort of traditional litigation. We have, cases that we're representing community groups in court. We do a lot of what I call community-based advocacy, which is providing the legal support for community groups and organizations to advocate, not in the litigation context, but again, to be able to address local boards and local governments around issues that they are confronting. So, for example, one of the issues that we work on is getting access to public water and sewer for communities that don't have it. And we found that in some cases, being able to engage with the local government and to secure those services is a critical step. We also do public policy research and public education around critical civil rights issues. And we also work with law students. We're trying to train sort of the next generation of civil rights lawyers so there'll be continued folks who can take up this mantle and engage in this struggle.
What does that look like? Is there a large pool? Are people still interested? Are they interested in fairly large numbers and becoming civil rights attorneys?
There is a consistent pool. I mean, obviously, I wish it was larger, but we have regularly, we work with 5 to 10 law students during the summer work in our office. We have interns during the year. We do lots of projects with law students, pro bono projects. We have 2 fellowships for recent law graduates, many of whom have gone on to really be doing civil rights work at the Center for Responsible Lending or at the Legal Defense Fund. And so there is a continuing stream of folks interested and hopefully by being engaged in this work, we're continuing to remind people of the need for this kind of civil rights and social justice advocacy.
Give us a big view of the struggle itself and perhaps how it's changed. There was a time when you could attack an entire institution, segregation, a poll tax. It violates a right to vote. Has that changed, and are you working – are the structures that now enforce and reinforce inequality, are they harder to attack through the law or easier? How does it work? Has it changed?
I think it has changed, and I think it is harder. There was a time where most civil rights advocacy was focused on discrimination, sort of direct, intentional discrimination. And at its height, the civil rights legislation that was adopted, the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, the Voting Rights Act, recognize that in addition to the intentional discrimination, that there were discriminatory impacts of what could be considered facially neutral actions by local governments or businesses or any other actor. I think now we're at a point where we've had success on the intentional discrimination, but the sort of structural inequalities exist. And the only way to address those is through looking at outcomes. And now we have a court and the legal system that's sort of backing away from that as a means of attacking discrimination.
So otherwise, well, let's talk about the specifics. The Supreme Court is taking up the Voting Rights Act, and I think the center is involved in that case as well. So tell us about the importance of that decision that we're about to hear.
So actually, we were not directly involved in the voting rights case. We were involved in the affirmative action in higher ed case, which is the other big civil rights case, but in front of the court right now. I mean, what we see what we're facing is potentially the most damaging Supreme Court term for civil rights in a decade. And what we see, I think, is a court really interested in rolling back the idea that there's discrimination still exists, or that there's anything that the law can do about it, that the law shouldn't reach these disparate effects or disparate impacts. And so I'm extremely concerned about where we will go if in fact the court does push this, I think, this what they call this colorblind agenda, but what I think is really an ahistorical view of our legacy of race discrimination.
Well, take another example. And again, I think here's some place where you can look at outcomes, say there's something clearly wrong, but I wonder how you attack it legally. And that is the incarceration rate of young African-American men and increasingly Latinos in our culture. Brown and black men disproportionately put in prison. There's something wrong with the system. Is there a legal attack based on outcomes?
I think there are a lot of folks working on that. I think there are legal attacks to be waged. I think that is discriminatory. These statistically significant disparities that when you're talking in the criminal justice system, they exist at all aspects from arrest to charging to conviction rates to bail to, you know, ultimately to incarceration. And so those have to be challenged. And there are folks doing good work around racial profiling and some of those issues. But that's a perfect example of looking at disparate effects, and that needs to be challenged. And I think what we're seeing from the courts is a pushback on being able to do that.
A lot of it, though, has to do with legally, that is to say, deliberative bodies, legislative bodies, criminalizing those things that they find occurring most often in the communities that we're talking about. So in a sense, you've legalized racism through the law. How do you challenge that? You have to say, well, we need to find different people to be making our laws, I guess.
Certainly, we need to find different people to be making our laws. I think one of the things that folks are doing, and they're doing it not just around criminal justice, but on schools, school discipline, resegregation of schools, is to continue to try to mount these creative, both legal and organizing challenges. I think one of the lessons, one of the ways things have changed, I think, for civil rights advocates is we've learned that the legal struggle is not enough by itself. It really works best when it's supporting broad-based, organized advocacy. And I think we're starting to see that happening in North Carolina.
Tell us about the case you are involved in, and that is the one regarding the use of race in higher education.
So there's a case that came out of the University of Texas challenging the use of race in higher ed and that it should be prohibited. There was a Supreme Court case in 2003 that came out of Michigan that said that diversity was a compelling interest for colleges and universities, and so therefore was permitted for the limited use of race was permitted. Now we have that being challenged, and that is up on appeal to the Supreme Court. We, the center and the dean of the law school, Jack Boger, and the university council did an amicus brief in that case on behalf of UNC Chapel Hill, supporting the limited use of race and supporting the interest that universities have in having diverse campuses. So that case was argued in October, and we expect a decision soon.
Tell us about that process of filing an amicus brief. Do you have to have standing with the court? Can anybody do that?
Pretty much anybody can do that. I mean, you have to have a statement of interest, sort of why you or as a party are submitting an amicus. Once you do that, you can then go ahead and do that. In the Fisher case, there were over 90 amicus briefs submitted from a range of colleges, businesses, the military, members of Congress. So it's fairly wide open. I mean, the question is how many of them get read or how they stand out in a big stack.
So you're about ready for change, it seems to me, as I look over the timeline. What's next for you?
Oh, I'm going to stay at the center as long. I mean, I really, the center is an incredible place. We're doing really innovative, I think, civil rights advocacy. We have a brilliant staff. My colleagues are doing great work. We have a major school segregation case that's going to be litigating this spring. We have an environmental justice case. So I'm hoping that my resume will look less like a person on the run from the federal government than it has in the past.
Too late for that, I'm afraid. What about, you know, this idea that particularly when it comes to those areas of the academy that could serve the needs of a greater society, and particularly an underserved society, that part of the training should be in advocacy, that if you're going to be a doctor, you need to advocate for the health needs of the underserved, et cetera, and a lawyer, the same thing. Whatever law you practice, advocacy should be part of what you learn in school, at the university. What do you think?
I think that's critical, and I think at UNC, I think they've done a good job pushing that message. What's harder is how you put that into practice. You know, students are caught up in their classes and in their work, and so we work with a lot of law students, and I encourage them to come with us when we're going to court hearings or things like this. And, you know, they're always trying to balance their classes. And I remind them of Mark Twain's exhortation, never to let your studies interfere with your education.
Excellent, Mark. Thank you so very much. As your education continues, we will stay tuned. Thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Mark Dorison, managing attorney at the UNC Center for Civil Rights, a member of the Orange County Board of Commissioners. This is The State of Things. Thank you for listening. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wen and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blyde is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.